From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, President Obama is ready to ask Congress for $1 billion to bolster security in Europe and increase American troop numbers in the region.
The United States will pre-position more equipment in Europe. We will be expanding our exercises and training with allies to increase the readiness of our forces.
Also today, the controversial Pakistani politician whose arrest in London threatens chaos 4,000 miles away, and the firestorm surrounding the captivity and release of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl continues to escalate.
I think that he should be tried as a deserter and court-martialed. I would personally like to see him give a formal apology to us, his unit, and the families of those lost.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of the day's news headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. President Barack Obama has announced a $1 billion fund to increase military deployments in Europe amid concerns over the Russia-Ukraine situation. The president made the statement at an airbase in Poland. Mr. Obama said his country's commitment to its European allies is sacrosanct. Jack Parak reports.
Many Eastern European countries, especially the ones which border Russia, are growing increasingly worried about the security situation around the Ukraine crisis. Mr. Obama reaffirmed his commitment to supporting Europe in this matter, saying it's a cornerstone of American security. During his trip, the president will meet NATO leaders from across Europe and will attend the G7 summit in Brussels of the world's seven most powerful economies, with a notable absence of Russia. Mr. Obama is predicted to urge his G7 counterparts to reassert a united front on Russia with regards to the Ukraine crisis.
A Pakistani political leader has been arrested in London on money laundering charges. Media reports say the leader of the MQM party, Altaf Hussain, is in custody following a raid on his home in the northwest of the capital. From London, Catherine Drew reports.
Officers from London's Metropolitan Police reportedly detained 60-year-old Altaf Hussain at his home in the northwest of the capital on Tuesday. Police, who say they will not give out any details, have confirmed they are searching the address where the arrest took place. Mr. Hussain has lived in Britain since 1991, insisting his life would be at risk if he returned to Pakistan. The MQM is a secular party and is popular in the city of Karachi, where police are on alert amid reports of violence. Security is also being tightened around the British mission and other buildings in the city, which has seen recent politically motivated violence.
The White House is on the defensive over the exchange of five senior Taliban militants for an American soldier held captive for years. U.S. President Barack Obama is standing by the deal, while political opponents are criticizing the move. Unflattering portrayals of the freed Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl by former comrades are fueling the debate. Malcolm Brown has more from Washington.
The backlash is based in large part on the circumstances surrounding Bo Bergdahl's disappearance from his base in Afghanistan almost 5 years ago. Former platoon mates like Army Specialist Sam Masamitsu are angry.
I think that he should be tried as a deserter and court-martialed.
The growing chorus of criticism, especially from within the ranks, has put President Obama on the defensive.
Whatever those circumstances may turn out to be, we still get an American soldier back if he's held in captivity. Period.
Other critics say the swap was illegal and will encourage the taking of American prisoners in the future.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Government-held areas of Syria are voting in a presidential election criticized by the West. The poll goes ahead despite an ongoing civil war, which has claimed tens of thousands of lives. President Bashar al-Assad is expected to win a third 7-year term in office. In the U.S. state of Wisconsin, two 12-year-old girls have been charged with attempted murder after stabbing a classmate 19 times and leaving them in the woods. It's reported the girls committed the crime to show dedication to a fictional character called Slenderman, who appears in stories on the website Creepypasta. According to authorities, they may be charged as adults due to the crime's calculated nature. Authorities in Saudi Arabia say almost 300 people have already been killed by the deadly MERS virus, which stands for Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. Nearly 700 cases have been reported in the country. The numbers were higher than expected, and cases have also been confirmed in a dozen additional countries. And American car giant General Motors has posted their best monthly sales figures since August 2008. This comes despite a series of highly publicized vehicle recalls, some of which are linked to fatalities. Here's William Denslow from New York.
Compared with data from last year, General Motors say sales in May are up 13%, coming in better than some analysts expected. It's a sign for some that consumers are looking beyond a series of recalls. GM admit that 13 deaths can be connected to issues with ignition switches in some of their vehicles. This month, Ford and Chrysler both performed well, with Chrysler posting a 17% boost in sales. Jeeps and their Ram pickup truck both proving popular. William Denslow, New York.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Barack Obama has announced new measures to bolster security in Central and Eastern Europe. While on a visit to Poland, the US president said he'll be asking Congress for $1 billion for what the White House is calling a European Reassurance Initiative. That would increase American troops' presence in the region, with additional exercises, training and more US Navy ships sent to the Baltic and Black Seas. But NATO reached an agreement with Russia after the end of the Cold War, promising to refrain from sending substantial numbers of troops to Eastern Europe. FSN's Lorna Shaddick asked Michael Brown, the Dean of the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University, whether this new announcement might jeopardize that deal.
Well, I think this is framed carefully to say that these will be exercises and training activities and military forces on rotation. My reading of the announcement is that they are being careful not to have an increased permanent presence in these countries.
And you mentioned that this will have to obviously go through Congress. What is the likelihood of success in that regard?
The U.S. federal budget's very tight. There are multiple demands on U.S. defense spending. In February, the Pentagon announced that there would be budget cuts. And in April, when President Obama visited Asia, he was explicit in saying that the U.S. would not be reducing its presence in Asia. And so the administration and Congress will have to figure out where this money is going to come from.
Indeed, it's interesting in terms of the so-called pivot to Asia or rebalancing towards Asia. How does this fit in with that? Because to some people, perhaps it may come as a bit of a surprise. We thought that the President Obama's foreign policy was going to be very much focused on the Asia-Pacific region, yet now we seem to be pivoting back towards Europe again as well.
The administration in recent years has been careful to talk about U.S. strategic policy in terms of rebalancing, because indeed if you're pivoting, you're really pivoting away from one place and pivoting toward another. And the rebalancing formulation is actually more accurate and more useful. You know, the administration's position, which I think is correct, is that the U.S. can do multiple things at the same time. It can be focused on Asia, focused on Europe and the Middle East, and do other things simultaneously. What the administration's trying to do here is to provide some added and tangible sign of the U.S.'s continuing commitment to Europe in light of Russia's recent aggression in Ukraine.
And talking of that aggression, certainly very much a topic last time President Obama was in Europe as well. Do you feel that that has perhaps shielded him from some criticisms he may otherwise have faced from European allies about, for example, NSA surveillance?
Well, I would say that the NSA revelations have had a significant impact on U.S.-European relations and indeed with U.S. relations around the world. And it's especially unfortunate because right now you would hope that the United States and Europe, especially the United States and Germany, would have a good, strong relationship in the face of Russian aggression. But because of the NSA revelations, transatlantic ties have been strained over the past year. And in my view, the Obama administration has not done enough to modify its position on these kinds of intelligence activities, and the Obama administration hasn't done enough to repair the damage that's been done to U.S.-European relations.
FSN's Lorna Shaddock talking to international affairs expert Michael Brown. This is FSN Reports. America's top general says the army will not ignore evidence of misconduct on the part of newly freed soldier Bo Bergdahl. General Martin Dempsey said questions about Sergeant Bergdahl's conduct are completely separate from efforts to rescue him. Bergdahl spent nearly 5 years in Taliban captivity before the US secured his release in a prisoner swap with five Taliban commanders. The White House continues to respond to mounting criticism over the deal, with President Obama defending the terms while on his European tour.
Regardless of the circumstances, whatever those circumstances may turn out to be, we still get an American soldier back if he's held in captivity. Period. Full stop. We don't condition that.
For more on the growing controversy, I spoke to Jeff Korn, professor with South Texas College of Law and a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel.
If it turns out that he deliberately left his post to desert and then he was captured, and then as a result of that, American forces were put in jeopardy trying to recover him, that's a very serious crime in military law. And I think most military commanders responsible for making a determination of whether to consider a prosecution would be inclined to consider it. But the challenge is the evidence. Mm-hmm. And right now, all we have is a lot of hearsay and speculation.
So have you been surprised, as a retired lieutenant colonel, are you surprised by this wave of condemnation aimed at Bergdahl from members of his own former unit?
Not in the least, because the members of his unit were the ones who, in a small combat outpost, had to deal firsthand with the negative consequences of a member of their team abandoning his post. And it does seem fairly clear that he was not snatched by the Taliban while he was on duty. I mean, there's no indication that there was a raid into the combat outpost and he was captured. It appears he somehow put himself in a position where he was defenseless and he was able to be captured. And the members of the unit, I think, would logically consider that a breach of the most fundamental duty of a fellow soldier, which is to general order number one, which soldiers are taught, guard everything within the limits of my post and quit my post only when properly relieved. And so if he quit his position for whatever reason, I mean, even if he was suffering some type of mental breakdown, for other members of the unit, they're going to see that as relatively unforgivable.
And what form of punishment does desertion carry in the United States military?
Well, it's a complicated question, because if you have deserted, which means that we can prove that you not only abandoned your post without authority, but that you did it with an intent to remain away permanently, then it could range everywhere from administrative disciplinary sanction to being discharged from the military with something less than an honorable discharge, to an actual court-martial, which could result in a federal conviction and a prison term and a dishonorable discharge. And if you can add the element that he deserted to avoid hazardous duty, it's an even more aggravated form of the crime. And the penalty, in theory, the maximum penalty could be decades of prison, although I don't see that as likely.
And what do you think will most likely be happening to Sergeant Bergdahl as we speak? Will this political firestorm over his captivity and release be having a bearing on his current situation? Because he's still in that hospital in Germany.
Okay, so what's happening to him now? There is a very deliberate and carefully plotted out recovery and reintegration process. It's something we've done before. And basically, there are dozens of experts on every aspect of this reintegration, from mental health to pay and allowances, to rank, to family issues, to physical condition, and to intelligence debriefing, that are circling around, you know, waiting for their opportunity to perform their part of this mosaic task. What's going to happen is a very deliberate effort to debrief him, not only because we want to know what he did, but he also could be a potential treasure trove of information about the Taliban themselves.
Jeff Korn, professor with South Texas College of Law and a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. Now, controversial Pakistani politician leader Altaf Hussain has been arrested in London. The leader of the MQM, Karachi's most powerful political party, is reportedly in custody on money laundering charges. Mr. Hussain effectively runs the Pakistani city remotely from his London home. FSN's Ollie Barrett spoke to me earlier.
Yes, there was some initial confusion with MQM officials insisting that Altaf Hussain had not been arrested, had simply been questioned by police, but the Metropolitan Police did confirm to me that a 60-year-old man was arrested on suspicion of money laundering offences and had been detained into custody. But as I say, some confusion in the initial hours after the Metropolitan Police announced the arrest of a 60-year-old man in northwest London, with MQM insiders trying to deny essentially that it was Altaf Hussain.
And Ollie, how significant are MQM's operations in London?
MQM has offices here in London, and essentially Altaf Hussain runs the city of Karachi remotely from the British capital city. MQM protests in favour of MQM, that is, have taken place at the Pakistani High Commission here in London in recent years. Those who support the MQM often come here to demonstrate their feelings. Today, here in London, the reaction to Altaf Hussain's arrest among Pakistanis in London has been more measured than what has been seen on the streets of Karachi.
If he done something bad, so he has to face the court or charges.
If he's really committed any crime or if he's done anything wrong, so he should be arrested. And if the lawyers are quite good for him and if he's not guilty, he'll be free. So it should be okay.
You're being very calm in your response, whereas back home it seems people are less calm.
Well, they people are quite related to him. They think he's a big leader, or they think he's a very big man.
The legal process are very clear here. So when the things go to the court, the judge will be decide who is right, who is wrong.
But this is just the latest investigation into MQM in the UK.
Yes, there have been a series of investigations here in the UK into MQM in recent years. One has looked into whether Altaf Hussain's televised speeches have incited violence back in Pakistan, and that is a charge that Altaf Hussain himself denies. Another investigation has been into whether the MQM has paid its UK taxes properly. A further investigation or further accusations are that the MQM extorts money from businesses in Karachi and ships that money to the UK, another charge that the party denies. The most high-profile investigation has been after the 2010 murder here in London of a senior MQM leader called Imran Farooq. No one, though, has ever been charged formally with that killing.
Ollie Barrett in London. Now, as G7 leaders gather in Brussels for a summit meeting that will not include Russian President Vladimir Putin, a British non-governmental organisation is warning that the continent faces a looming food and fuel crisis. A new report published by Oxfam says the standoff between G7 leaders and Russia underscores the need for Europe to reassess the mix of energy on which its people rely. Oxfam researchers say an over-reliance on fossil fuels, much of which emanate from Russia, is leading to rising costs that disproportionately affect the poor. Hannah Stoddart is the head of food and climate policy for Oxfam.
I think people are unaware of the fact that the political crisis that is playing out on Europe's eastern border does risk an energy price crisis. And the very fact that Russia is absent from the G7 is a wake-up call on this issue. What Oxfam is saying as well is that this situation adds further pressure to household bills at a time when climate change also risks driving up the costs of food imports as well. So what we're seeing is that EU citizens effectively risk being caught in what you could call an energy and food price pincer, which will force the poorest in cases to choose between heating and eating, and Oxfam's pretty concerned about that.
So are we saying that it would be good for Russia to be around the G7 table summit?
Well, what we're saying really is that Europe is at a crossroads at the moment. So it has a very obvious choice. It can either reduce dependency on Russian energy imports that are clearly at risk from this political instability. It can also, of course, secure its food supplies, which are at risk from climate change, through taking steps to urgently tackle climate change, to reduce energy demand, and to boost renewable energy in Europe. Now, we think that this will bring down carbon emissions, make energy more affordable, and reduce the risks from climate change to our food supply in Europe. Mm. Now, this is a much better option than what is the opposite dead-end route of digging up more coal in Europe, going down the route of fracking, which only leads to more expensive bills, risks runaway climate change, and threatens our food supplies. So as Europe is contemplating how to deal with this issue, both within Europe, there's a big meeting going on of leaders at the moment, a big negotiation with leaders at the moment on the climate and energy package for 2030. So as Europe is discussing this, we hope that at the G7 as well, European countries with other G7 countries can come to a climate-friendly solution to this crisis.
Hannah Stoddart of Oxfam talking to Britain's LBC Radio. And finally, FSN Spotlight, the segment of the show where we try to bring you a story you might have missed. With today's edition, Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, the American literature no longer being taught in British schools. Last week, as the United States mourned the death of author and poet Maya Angelou, she was making headlines on the other side of the Atlantic for a different reason. Her works, alongside those of Harper Lee and Arthur Miller, were removed from the curriculum in Britain's public schools. Michael Gove, the government's education minister, ruled that British children should be studying more British writers for the GCSE, the British equivalent of America's SAT. Bonnie Greer is an American-born playwright and novelist who has lived in London for nearly 30 years. She talked about the curriculum changes to Clive Bull of Britain's LBC Radio.
Well, you know, first of all, you know, anyone who speaks or reads English and who isn't acquainted with Shakespeare, that's a very serious matter as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, I don't have any problems with Shakespeare, nor Austen. I mean, I'm president of the Bronte Society, so I would throw in the Brontes as well. But, I mean, this isn't just about that. You know, we have in Michael Gove one of the arguably most erudite, well-read people in public life. I've done some critics' jobs on TV with Michael Gove, really, you know, right on the money. But he's allowed himself, and maybe this is the way he really is, to use his office of state as some kind of ideological crusade that he's on. I have no idea what this crusade is, but it's all very strange, extremely strange, and quite undermining. He's talking about going to somewhere where I guess he'd have a classroom full of Mr. Chips teaching people who are, frankly, even at my age, all of that was tired by the time I was at school in the 60s. So, and certainly by the time he was there. So it's all, you know, it's all a bit weird. It's the only thing I can put with you, Clive. It's just weird.
Do you think perhaps he's going down this line of making things more old-fashioned, that he's sort of going for a popular appeal by saying he's not dumbing things down anymore? He's going for the traditional. He's going for Shakespeare and Dickens, quite right, as you say, nothing wrong with those.
No.
And proper exams, sit-down exams, none of this coursework stuff. That it's about being kind of traditional. Do you think there might be something in that?
Well, first of all, Michael Gove, I mean, I could be wrong, but he hasn't taught a day, a second, an hour in a classroom. So he's basically a bureaucrat who's got a big train set, and he's tinkering with it to make it into the you know, the face of himself. I you know, this is like deeply weird to me. I can't even begin to assess what he's on about. This isn't even taught in your staunchest, strictest of modern public schools. I don't know where he's going. None of it makes any sense. And the only thing that I can sort of assume is that he's got some kind of idea in the back of his noggin that state schools are sort of bastions of some kind of Marxist conspiracy and, you know, or left-wing madness, and he's going to root it out by putting in Dickens and Shakespeare. Unfortunately, you know, Shakespeare, of course, will fail him. And Dickens, who, as I say, everyone should be acquainted with Dickens. Dickens takes a bit of getting into when you're a young person. It is possible, and it should be attempted, but it isn't an easy thing to do. And if a young person feels that they're failing at reading Dickens, which, after all, is written in a 19th century style, then that young person may feel that they're not very intelligent. And not being able to read Dickens or Shakespeare is not a mark of your intelligence, nor is being able to read them a mark of your intelligence.
And would we be missing anything if we didn't have books like To Kill a Mockingbird and Of Mice and Men in the syllabus?
I think what you want to do with a young person, above all, what you want to do is instill some sort of value in this person as they're reading. Because remember, you're forming human beings as well. It's not just about, you're not teaching robots. These are human beings. And we all know that being in a classroom with an inspirational teacher or encountering a book that really means a lot to you can be really life-forming. So what teachers try to do is attach a young person as quickly and as viscerally as possible and emotionally as possible to as great a piece of literature that is as accessible to that person as they're living their lives now. And then gradually you walk them into the big canon. I mean, I've taught Shakespeare in this country to people who never thought they could access Shakespeare. And of course you can, but you have to first allow people to go through their own portal.
And just going off in the other direction, there were reports a couple of weeks ago that the English A-level was going to include studying the likes of Russell Brand and Dizzy Rascal. I mean, do you think a syllabus should include some more contemporary, some oddities like that as well?
Well, I'm old-fashioned in the sense that if you're going to read really contemporary literature, real contemporary stuff, you should read some great people. You know, respect to Dizzy Rascal and Russell Brand, but I mean, these people aren't going to be around in the next 5 or 10 years in terms of being able to reference back to something.
They're not going to be studying Dizzy Rascal or Russell Brand in 200 years.
I mean, as I say, respect to them, but they're not going to be one of the immortals, you know. So, you know, as you grow up, you're not going to look back at the work of Russell Brand and go, gosh, you know, I can, you know, that's Russell Brand. No, it's not going to happen.
I hope not.
No. So what you want is for people to be able to remember things so that they can pass those things down, because that, Clive, is what civilization is.
That's playwright and novelist Bonnie Greer. She's originally from Chicago, but she's now a resident of London and the Chancellor of Kingston University in Britain. She was talking there to Clive Bull of Britain's LBC Radio. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Wednesday, the global computer virus that cyber police on both sides of the Atlantic are trying to arrest. That's Wednesday, but for now I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.